Third chef adds, when someone mentions fagot de haricots verts, everyone laughs. It's a traditional Christmas dish that all the cleches were supposed to prepare the previous year. The dish requires blanching green beans, wrapping clusters of the beans in thin slices of smoked pork, piercing the combination with a toothpick, and then grilling it. Apparently, this was too much even for the ascetics-obsessed cleche chefs, though they don't balk at being told to cut a kiwi into the shape of a flower. Another driving principle of the commission menus is that if at first the kids don't like something, they should try it repeatedly. Merle reminds the chefs to introduce new foods gradually and to prepare the foods all different ways. She suggests introducing berries first as a puree, since kids will already be familiar with that texture. After that, the chefs can serve the berries cut into pieces. One chef asks what to do about grapefruit. Merle suggests serving a thin slice sprinkled with sugar, then gradually serving it on its own. The same goes for spinach.
Our kids don't eat spinach at all. It all goes in the garbage,
one chef grumbles. Merle tells her to mix it with rice to make it more appetizing. She says she'll send out a technical sheet to remind everyone how to do this.
You repurpose spinach in different ways throughout the year. Eventually, they will like it, she promises.
Merle says that once one child starts eating spinach, the others will follow.
It's the principle of nutritional education, she says.
Vegetables are a big concern for the group. One cook says her kids won't eat green beans unless they're slathered in crème fraîche or bechamel sauce.
You need to strike a balance. Sometimes we sauce, sometimes we salt,
Merle suggests. Then there's a long discussion of rhubarb. After about 2 hours under the fluorescent lights, I'm fading a bit. I'd like to go home and have dinner, but the commission hasn't even gotten to the menu for the upcoming Christmas meal.
The foie gras, non?
One chef suggests as an appetizer. Another counters with duck mousse. At first I assume that they're both joking, but no one laughs. The group then debates whether to have salmon or tuna for the main course. Their first choice is monkfish, but Merle says it's too expensive. And what about the cheese course? Merle vetoes goat cheese with herbs because the kids had goat cheese at their fall picnic. The group finally settles on a menu that includes fish, broccoli mousse, and two kinds of cow's milk cheese. Dessert is an apple cinnamon cake, a yogurt cake with carrots, and a traditional Christmas galette with pears and chocolate. You can't veer too much from tradition. Parents will want a galette, someone says. For the afternoon goûter that day, Merle worries that a mousse made of industrial chocolate won't be sufficiently festive. They settle on a more elaborate chocolat liégeois, a chocolate mousse sundae in a glass, topped with whipped cream. Not once does anyone suggest that a flavor might be too intense or complicated for a child's palate. None of the foods are outrageously strong. There are a lot of herbs, but no mustards, pickles, or olives. But there are mushrooms, celery, and every other manner of vegetable in abundance. The point isn't that every kid will like everything. It's that he'll give each food a chance. Not long after I sit in on the commission menus, a friend loans me a book called The Man Who Ate Everything by the American food writer Jeffrey Steingarten. Steingarten writes that when he was named food critic for Vogue, he decided that his personal food preferences made him unfairly biased. I feared that I could be no more objective than an art critic who detests the color yellow, he writes. He embarks on a project to see if he can make himself like the foods he despises. Steingarten's hated foods include kimchi, the fermented cabbage that's a national dish of Korea, swordfish, anchovies, dill, clams, lard, and desserts in Indian restaurants, which he says have the taste and texture of face creams. He reads up on the science of taste and concludes that the main problem with new foods is simply that they're new. So just having them around should chip away at the eater's innate resistance. Steingarten bravely decides to eat one of his hated foods each day. He also tries to eat very good versions of each food, chopped anchovies in garlic sauce in northern Italy, a perfectly done cappellini in white clam sauce at a restaurant on Long Island. He spends an entire afternoon cooking lard from scratch and eats kimchi 10 times at 10 different Korean restaurants. After 6 months, Steingarten still hates Indian desserts. Not every Indian dessert has the texture and taste of face cream. Far from it. Some have the texture and taste of tennis balls. But he comes to like, and even crave, nearly all of his other formerly detested foods. By the 10th portion of kimchi, it has become my national pickle, too, he writes. He concludes that no smells or tastes are innately repulsive, and what's learned can be forgot. Steingarten's experiment sums up the French approach to feeding kids. If you keep trying things, you eventually come around to liking most of them. Steingarten discovered this by reading up on the science of taste. But middle-class French parents seem to know it intuitively and do it automatically. In France, the idea of reintroducing a broad range of vegetables and other foods isn't just one idea among many. It's a guiding culinary principle for kids. The ordinary middle-class French parents I meet are evangelical about the idea that there's a rich world of flavors out there, which their children must be educated to appreciate. This isn't just some theoretical ideal that can only play out in the controlled environment of the creche. It actually happens in the kitchens and dining rooms of ordinary French families. I see it firsthand when I visit the home of Fanny, the publisher who lives in a high-ceilinged apartment in eastern Paris with her husband, Vincent, 4-year-old Lucie, and 3-month-old Antoine. Fanny has pretty rounded features and a thoughtful gaze. She usually arrives home from work by 6 and serves Lucie dinner at 6:30, while Antoine sits in a bouncy chair drinking his bottle. On weeknights, Fanny and Vincent eat together once the kids are asleep. Fanny says she rarely makes anything as complex as the braised endive and chard that Lucie used to eat at the creche. Still, she views each night's dinner as part of Lucie's culinary education. She doesn't worry too much about how much Lucie eats, but she insists that Lucie has at least a bite of every dish on her plate. "Je hâte de taste everything," Fanny says, echoing a rule I hear from almost every French mother I speak to about food. One extension of the tasting principle is that, in France, everyone eats the same dinner. There are no choices or substitutions. I never ask, "What do you want?" It's, "I'm serving this," Fanny tells me. If she doesn't finish a dish, it's okay, but we all eat the same thing. American parents might see this as lording it over their helpless offspring. Fanny thinks it empowers Lucie. She feels bigger when we all eat not the same portions, but the same thing. Fanny says American visitors are amazed when they see Lucie at a meal. They say, "How come your daughter already knows the difference between camembert, gruyère, and chèvre?" Fanny also tries to make the meal fun. Lucie already knows how to make cakes, since she and her mother bake together most weekends. Fanny has Lucie play some role in making dinner, too, by preparing some of the food or setting the table. "We help her, but we make it playful, and eats every day," she says. When it's time to eat, Fanny doesn't austerely wave her finger at Lucie and order her to taste things. They talk about the food. Often they discuss the flavor of each cheese, and having participated in preparing the meal, Lucie is invested in how it turns out. There's complicity. If a certain dish is a flop, "We all have a laugh about it," Fanny says. Part of keeping the mood light is keeping the meal brief. Fanny says that once Lucie has tasted everything, she's allowed to leave the table. The book Votre Enfant says a meal with young kids shouldn't last more than 30 minutes. French kids learn to linger over longer meals as they get older, and as they start going to bed later, they eat more weeknight dinners with their parents. Planning the dinner menu is a lesson in balance. I'm struck by how French mothers like Fanny seem to have the day's culinary rhythm mapped out in their heads. They assume that their kids will have their one big protein-heavy meal at lunchtime. For dinner, they mostly serve carbohydrates like pasta, along with vegetables. Fanny may have just raced home from the office, but as they do at the creche, she calmly serves dinner in courses. She gives Lucy a cold vegetable starter, such as shredded carrots in a vinaigrette. Then there's a main course, usually pasta or rice with vegetables. Occasionally she'll cook a bit of fish or meat, but usually she expects Lucy to have had most of her protein at lunch.
I try to avoid proteins at night because I think I've been educated like that. They say once per day is enough. I try to focus on the vegetables.
Some parents tell me that, in winter, they often serve soup for dinner along with a baguette or maybe a bit of pasta. It's a filling meal that relies heavily on grains and vegetables. A lot of parents puree these soups, and that's dinner. Kids might drink some juice at breakfast or at the afternoon goûter, but at lunch and dinner they drink water, usually at room temperature or slightly chilled. Weekends are for family meals. Almost all the French families I know have a large lunch en famille on both Saturday and Sunday. The kids are usually involved in cooking and setting up these meals.
On weekends, we bake, we cook. I have cookbooks for children. They have their own recipes, says Denise, the medical ethicist and mother of two girls.
After all these preparations, they sit down to eat. The French sociologists Claude Fischler and Estelle Masson, authors of the book Manger, say that a French person who eats a sandwich on the fly for lunch doesn't even count this as having eaten. For the French, eating means sitting at the table with others, taking one's time, and not doing other things at the same time. Whereas for Americans, health is seen as the main reason for eating. At Bean's fifth birthday party, I announce that it's time for the cake. Suddenly, the kids, who've been raucously playing, file into our dining room and sit down calmly at the table. They're all sage at once. Bean sits at the head of the table and hands out plates, spoons, and napkins. Except for lighting the candles and carrying out the cake, I don't have much of a role. By 5 years old, sitting calmly at the table for any kind of eating is an automatic reflex for French kids. There's no question of eating on the couch, in front of the television, or while looking at the computer. Of course, one of the benefits of having some cadre in your home is that you can go outside of a cadre without worrying that it will collapse. Denise tells me that once a week she lets her two girls, who are 7 and 9, have dinner in front of the television. On weekends, and during those ubiquitous school holidays, French parents are more relaxed about what time their kids eat and go to bed. They trust the cadre to be there when they need it again. Magazines run articles about easing your kids back onto an earlier schedule once you get back from vacation. When we're on holiday with Hélène and William, I panic a bit when it's 1:30 and William still hasn't gotten home with some of the ingredients for our lunch. But Hélène figures that the kids can adapt. They are people, after all, who, like us, are capable of coping with a bit of frustration. She breaks open a bag of potato chips, and the six kids all gather at the kitchen table to eat them. Then they pile outside to play again until lunch is ready. It's no big deal. We all cope. A little while later, we all have a long, lovely meal at the table that we've set up under a tree. If overparenting was an airline, Park Slope, Brooklyn would be its hub. Every parenting trend and new product seems to originate or refuel there. Park Slope is home to New York's first baby-wearing and breastfeeding boutique and to a $15,000 per year preschool where teachers actively discourage and stop superhero play. If you live in Park Slope, baby bodyguards will kid-proof your duplex for $600. The company's founder explains that, "Once I gave birth and my son became part of the external world, my fear and anxiety kicked in." Despite Park Slope's reputation for zealous parenting, I'm unprepared for what I witness in a playground there on a sunny Sunday morning. At first, the father and son I spot just seem to be doing a particularly energetic version of narrated play. The boy looks about 6. The father, in expensive jeans and a stylish weekend stubble, has followed him to the top of the jungle gym. In a bilingual twist, He's giving the boy a running commentary in both English and what sounds like American-accented German. The son seems used to his father's heading down the slide behind him. When they move to the swings, the father continues his bilingual soliloquy while pushing. This is all still within the bounds of what I've seen elsewhere. But then the mother arrives. She's a rail-thin brunette in her own pair of expensive jeans, carrying a bag of produce from the farmer's market next door.
"Here's your parsley snack. Do you want your parsley snack?" she says to the boy, handing him a green sprig.
"Parsley? A snack?"
I think I understand the intention. These parents don't want their son to be fat. They want him to have a varied palate. They see themselves as original thinkers who can provide him with unusual experiences, German and parsley surely being just a small sampling. And I grant them that parsley doesn't run the risk of ruining their son's, or frankly anyone's, appetite. But there's a reason why parsley has never caught on as a snack. It's a seasoning. It doesn't taste good all by itself. I get the feeling that these parents are trying to remove their son from the collective wisdom of our species and the basic chemistry of what tastes good. I can only imagine the effort this requires. What happens when he discovers cookies? When I mention the parsley snack incident to American parents, they're not surprised. They concede that parsley isn't a snack, but they admire the effort. At that impressionable age, why not try? In the hothouse environment of Park Slope, some parents have gone beyond the American question, how do we speed up the stages of development? They're now asking how they can override basic sensory experiences. I realize I'm guilty of this, too, when I take Bean to her first Halloween party, when she's about 2. The French don't widely celebrate the holiday. I go to one adult Halloween party where all the women are dressed as sexy witches, and most of the men are Draculas. So each year, a group of Anglophone mothers in Paris takes over the top floor of a Starbucks near the Bastille and sets up little trick-or-treat stations around the room. As soon as Bean grasps the concept, all these people are giving her candy, she begins to eat it. She doesn't just eat a few pieces. She tries to eat all the candy in her bag. She sits in a corner of the room stuffing pink, yellow, and green gooey masses into her mouth. I have to intervene to slow her down. It occurs to me then that I've taken the wrong approach to sweets. Before this Halloween, Bean had barely ever eaten refined sugar. To my knowledge, she hadn't had a single gummy bear. Like the Parsley parents, I tried to pretend that such things didn't exist. I've watched other Anglophone parents agonize about giving their kids sweets. One afternoon, a British mother I know tells me her little girl can't have a cookie, although all the other kids are having them, explaining, "She doesn't need to know about that." Another mom I know, a psychologist, looks to be in agony over whether to let her 18-month-old have a popsicle, even though it's the end of a hot summer day and all our kids are playing outside. She finally concedes. I see a couple with 3 advanced degrees between them convene a nervous meeting over whether their 4-year-old can have a lollipop. But sugar does exist, and French parents know it. They don't try to eliminate all sweets from their children's diets. Rather, they fit sweets inside the cadre. For a French kid, candy has its place. It's a regular enough part of their lives that they don't gorge on it like freed prisoners the moment they get their hands on it. Mostly children seem to eat it at birthday parties, school events, and as the occasional treat. At these occasions, they're usually free to eat all they want. When I try to limit the boys' intake of candy and chocolate cake at the Cleches' Christmas party, one of their caregivers intervenes. She tells me I should just let them enjoy the party and be free. I think of my skinny friend, Virginie, who pays strict attention to what she eats on weekdays, then eats whatever she wants on weekends. Kids, too, need moments when the regular rules don't apply. But parents decide when these moments are. When I drop Bean off at a birthday party for Abigail, a little girl in our building, she's the first guest to arrive. We haven't yet figured out that you're not supposed to be punctual for kids' birthdays. Abigail's mom has just set out plates of cookies and candy on a table. Abigail asks her mom if she can have some of the candy. Her mom says, no, and explains that it isn't yet time to eat it. In what seems to me like a minor miracle, Abigail looks longingly at the candy, then runs off with Bean to play in another room.
chocolate has a more regular place in the lives of French kids. Middle-class French parents talk about chocolate as if it's just another food group, albeit one to eat in moderation. When Fanny describes what Lucie eats in a typical day, the menu includes a bit of cookies or cake, and obviously she wants chocolate in there somewhere, Fanny says. Alain gives her kids hot chocolate when it's cold outside. She serves it for breakfast, along with a hunk of baguette, or makes it their afternoon goûter, along with some cookies. My kids love reading books about Chopi, a French children's book character modeled on a penguin. When he's sick, his mom lets him stay home and drink hot chocolate. I take my kids to see a performance of Goldilocks and the Three Bears at a theater near our house. The bears don't eat oatmeal. They eat brouillé au chocolat, hot chocolate thickened with flour.
It's a compensation for going to school, and I guess it gives them some energy, explains Denise, the medical ethicist.
She shuns McDonald's and makes her daughter's dinner from scratch each night, but she gives each girl a bar of chocolate for breakfast, along with some bread and a bit of fruit. French kids don't get a huge amount of chocolate. It's a small bar, or a drink's worth, or a strip on a pain au chocolat. They eat it happily and don't expect a second helping. But chocolate is a nutritional fixture for them, rather than a forbidden treat. Bean once comes home from the summer camp at her school with a chocolate sandwich, a baguette with a bar of chocolate inside. I'm so surprised I take a picture of it. I later learned that the chocolate sandwich, usually made with dark chocolate, is a classic French goûter. With sweets too, the cadre is key. French parents aren't afraid of sugary foods. In general, they will serve cake or cookies at lunch or at the goûter, but they don't give kids chocolate or rich desserts with dinner. What you eat in the evening just stays with you for years, Fanny explains. After dinner, Fanny typically serves fresh fruit or a fruit compote, those ubiquitous little tubs of applesauce with other pureed fruits mixed in. These come with or without added sugar. There's a compotes section in French supermarkets. Fanny says she also buys all different types of plain yogurt and then gets jams for Lucie to mix in. As in most realms, French parents aim at mealtimes to give kids both firm boundaries and freedom within those boundaries.
It's things like sitting at the table and tasting everything, Fanny explains. I'm not forcing her to finish, just to taste everything and sit with us.
I'm not sure exactly when I started serving my kids meals and courses, but I now do it at every meal. It's a stroke of French genius. This starts with breakfast. When the kids sit down, I put plates of cut-up fruit on the table. They nibble on this while I'm getting their toast or cereal ready. They can have juice at breakfast, but they know that for lunch and dinner, we drink water. Even the union organizer doesn't complain about that. We talk about how clean water makes us feel. At lunch and dinner, I serve vegetables first, when the kids are hungriest. We don't move on to the main course until they at least make a dent in the starter. Usually, they finish it. Except when I introduce an entirely new dish, I rarely have to resort to the tasting rule. If Leo won't eat a food the first time I serve it, he'll usually agree to at least smell it, and he'll take a nibble soon after that. Bean sometimes exploits the letter of the rule by eating a single piece of zucchini and then insisting that she has fulfilled her obligation. She recently declared that she will taste everything except salad, by which she means the actual green lettuce leaves. But for the most part, she quite likes the starters we serve. These include sliced avocado, tomato in a vinaigrette, or steamed broccoli with a bit of soy sauce. We all have a good chuckle when I serve carottes râpées, shredded carrots in a vinaigrette, and try to pronounce it. My kids come to the table hungry because, except for the goûter, they don't snack. It helps that other kids around them aren't snacking either, but even so, getting to this point required a steely will. I simply don't cave in to demands for a filling piece of bread or a whole banana between meals, and as the kids have gotten older, they've mostly stopped asking. If they do, I just say, "No, you're having dinner in 30 minutes." Unless they're very tired, they're usually fine with that. I feel a swell of accomplishment when I'm in the supermarket with Leo, and he points to a box of cookies and says, "Goûter." I try not to be too fanatical about this, or as Simon describes it, more French than the French.
When I'm cooking, I occasionally give the kids a little preview of dinner, a piece of tomato or a few chickpeas. When I'm introducing a new ingredient, like pine nuts, I'll offer them a few bites of it while I'm cooking to get them in the mood. I might even give them a sprig of parsley, though I wouldn't call it a snack. Obviously, they drink water whenever they want. Sometimes keeping my kids in the food cadre feels like a lot of work, especially when Simon travels. I'm often tempted to skip the starter, plop a bowl of pasta in front of them, and call it dinner. When I occasionally do this, they're quite happy to gobble it down. There's certainly no clamoring for salad and vegetables. But the kids don't have a choice. Like a French mom, I've accepted that it's my duty to teach them to like a variety of tastes and to eat meals that are équilibré. Also, like a French mom, I try to keep the whole day's menu balanced in my head. We mostly stick to the French formula of having large, protein-heavy lunches and lighter, carbohydrate-driven dinners with vegetables. The kids do eat a lot of pasta, though I try to vary the shape and the sauce. Whenever I have time, I make a big pot of soup for dinner, though I can't bring myself to puree it, and serve it with rice or bread. It's no surprise that the kids find the food more appetizing when it's made with fresh ingredients, and it looks good. I consider the balance of colors on their plates, and occasionally slip in some slices of tomato or avocado if dinner looks monotone. We have a collection of colorful melamine plates, but for dinner I use white, which makes the colors of the food pop and signals to the kids that we're having a grown-up meal. I tried to let them help themselves as much as possible. Beginning when the boys were quite young, I passed around a bowl of grated Parmesan on pasta nights and let them sprinkle it on all by themselves. They get to put a spoonful of sugar in their hot chocolates and occasionally in their yogurts. Bean frequently asks for a slice of camembert or a hunk of whatever cheese we've got at the end of the meal. Except for special occasions, we don't do cake or ice cream at night. I still won't serve them chocolate sandwiches. It's taken a while to make all this second nature. It helps that the boys in particular really like to eat. One of their teachers at the creche calls them gourmands, which is a polite way of saying that they eat a lot. She says their favorite word is encore, more. They've developed the annoying habit, possibly learned at the creche, of holding up their plates at the end of the meal to show that they've finished. Whatever sauce or liquid is left spills onto the table. I think at the creche, they've already mopped up the liquid with slices of baguette. Sweets are no longer non grata in our house. Now that we offer them in moderation, Bean doesn't treat each piece of candy as if it's her last. When it's really cold out, I make the kids hot chocolate in the morning. I serve it with yesterday's baguette, softened slightly in the microwave, and slices of apple, which the kids dip in their drinks. It feels like a very French breakfast. Alain's recipe for chocolat chaud. Mix about 6 cups. 1 to 2 teaspoons cocoa powder, 1 liter low-fat milk, sugar to taste. In a saucepan, mix 1 to 2 heaping teaspoons unsweetened cocoa powder with a small splash of cold or room-temperature milk. Blend well to form a thick paste. Add the rest of the milk and stir. The chocolate should spread evenly into the milk. Cook over medium heat until the mixture boils. Allow the hot chocolate to cool. Skim off any skin that has formed. Then pour it into mugs with spoons. Let kids add their own sugar at the table. Quick breakfast version. In a large mug, mix 1 teaspoon cocoa powder and a small splash of milk. Blend into a paste. Fill the rest of the mug with milk and mix. Heat the mug in the microwave for 2 minutes or until very hot. Stir in 1 teaspoon of sugar. Pour a bit of this hot cocoa concentrate into several mugs. Add cold or room temperature milk to each mug. Serve with a crusty baguette or any toasted bread. Chapter 13. It's me who decides. Leo, the swarthy twin, does everything quickly. I don't mean that he's gifted. I mean that he moves at twice the speed of ordinary humans. By age 2, he's developed a runner's physique from dashing from room to room. He even speaks quickly. As Bean's birthday approaches, he begins singing, "Happy birthday to ya!" in a high-pitched squeak.
The whole song is over in a few seconds. It's very hard to wrangle this little tornado. Already he can practically outrun me. When I go to the park with him, I'm in constant motion, too. He seems to regard the gates around play areas as merely an invitation to exit. One of the most impressive parts of French parenting, and perhaps the toughest one to master, is authority. Many French parents I meet have an easy, calm authority with their children that I can only envy. Their kids actually listen to them. French children aren't constantly dashing off, talking back, or engaging in prolonged negotiations. But how exactly do French parents pull this off? And how can I acquire this magical authority too? One Sunday morning, my neighbor, Frederic, witnesses me trying to cope with Leo when we bring our kids to the park. Frederic is a travel agent from Burgundy. She's in her mid-40s, with a raspy voice and a no-nonsense manner. After years of paperwork, she adopted Tina, a beautiful, red-headed 3-year-old from a Russian orphanage. At the time of our outing, she's been a mother for all of 3 months. But already Frederic is teaching me about éducation. Just by virtue of being French, she has a whole different vision of what's possible and pas possible. This becomes clear in the sandbox. Frederic and I are sitting on a ledge at its perimeter, trying to talk. But Leo keeps dashing outside the gate surrounding the sandbox. Each time he does this, I get up to chase him, scold him, and drag him back while he screams. It's irritating and exhausting. At first, Frederic watches this little ritual in silence. Then, without any condescension, she says that if I'm running after Leo all the time, we won't be able to indulge in the small pleasure of sitting and chatting for a few minutes. That's true, I say, but what can I do? Frederic says I should be sterner with Leo, so he knows that it's not okay to leave the sandbox.
Otherwise, you're running after him all the time. It doesn't work, she says.
In my mind, spending the afternoon chasing Leo is inevitable. In her mind, it's pas possible. Frederic's strategy doesn't seem to hold out much promise for me. I point out that I've been scolding Leo for the last 20 minutes. Frederic smiles. She says I need to make my no stronger and to really believe in it. The next time Leo tries to run outside the gate, I say no more sharply than usual. He leaves anyway. I follow and drag him back. You see, I say to Frederic, it's not possible. Frederic smiles again and says I need to make my no more convincing. What I lack, she says, is the belief that he's really going to listen. She tells me not to shout, but rather to speak with more conviction. I'm scared that I'll terrify him.
Don't worry, Frederic says, urging me on.
Leo doesn't listen the next time either, but I gradually feel my no's coming from a more convincing place. They're not louder, but they're more self-assured. I feel like I'm impersonating a different sort of parent. By the fourth try, when I'm finally brimming with conviction, Leo approaches a gate, but, miraculously, doesn't open it. He looks back and eyes me warily. I widen my eyes and try to look disapproving. After about 10 minutes, Leo stops trying to leave altogether. He seems to forget about the gate and just plays in a sandbox with Tina, Joey, and Bean. Soon, Frederic and I are chatting, with our legs stretched out in front of us. I'm shocked that Leo suddenly views me as an authority figure.
See that? Frederic says, not gloating. It was your tone of voice.
She points out that Leo doesn't appear to be traumatized. For the moment, and possibly for the first time ever, he actually seems like a French child. With all three kids suddenly sage at once, I can feel my shoulders falling a bit. It's an experience I've never really had in the park before. Maybe this is what it's like to be a French mother. I feel relaxed, but also foolish. If it's that easy, why haven't I been doing this for years? Saying no isn't exactly a cutting-edge parenting technique. What's new is Frederic's coaching me to drop my ambivalence and be certain about my own authority. What she tells me springs from her own upbringing and deepest beliefs. It comes out sounding like common sense. Frederic has the same certainty that what's most pleasant for us parents, being able to have a relaxing chat at the park while the kids play, is also best for children. This seems to be true. Leo is a lot less stressed than he was half an hour earlier. Instead of a constant cycle of escape and re-imprisonment, he's playing happily with the other kids. I'm ready to bottle my new technique, the fully felt no, and sell it off the back of a wagon. But Frederick warns me that there's no magic elixir for making kids respect your authority. It's always a work in progress.
There are no fixed rules, she says. You have to keep changing what you do.
That's unfortunate. So what else explains why French parents like Frederic have so much authority with their kids? How exactly do French parents summon this authority day after day, dinner after dinner? And how can I get some more of it? A French colleague of mine says that if I'm interested in authority, I must speak to her cousin Dominique. She says that Dominique, a French singer who's raising three kids in New York, is an unofficial expert in the differences between French and American parents. Dominique, 43, looks like the heroine of a Nouvelle Vague film. She has dark hair, delicate features, and an intense gazelle-like gaze. If I were thinner, better-looking, and could sing, I'd say that she and I were living mirror-image lives. She's a Parisian who's raising her children in New York. I'm an ex-New Yorker who's raising kids in Paris. Living in France has made me calmer and less neurotic, whereas despite Dominique's sultry good looks, she has adopted the bubbly self-analysis that comes from living in Manhattan. She speaks enthusiastic French-accented English, peppered with like and oh my god. Dominique arrived in New York as a 22-year-old student. She planned to study English for 6 months, then go home. But New York quickly became home.
I felt really good and stimulated and had great energy, something I hadn't felt in a long, long time in Paris, she says.
She married an American musician. Beginning when she first got pregnant, Dominique was also enchanted with American parenting.
There's a great sense of community that, in a way, you don't have as much in France. If you like yoga and you're pregnant, boom, you get into this group of pregnant women doing yoga.
She also started to notice the way kids are treated in the United States. At a big Thanksgiving with her husband's family, she was astonished to see that when a 3-year-old girl arrived, all 20 adults at the table stopped talking and focused on the child.
I thought, oh, this is incredible, this culture. It's like the kid is a god. It's really amazing. I'm like, no wonder Americans are so confident and so happy, and the French are so depressed. Here we are. Just look at the attention.
But over time, Dominique started to view this type of attention differently. She noticed that the same 3-year-old girl who'd stopped conversation at Thanksgiving was developing an oversized sense of entitlement.
I was like, that's it. This kid really annoys me. She's coming and she's thinking that because she's here, everyone has to stop their life and pay attention.
Dominique, whose own kids are 11, 8, and 2, says her doubts grew when she overheard students at her children's preschool responding to teachers' instructions with,
"You're not the boss of me."
"You would never see that in France, never," she says.
When she and her husband were invited for dinner at the homes of American friends with young kids, she often ended up doing most of the cooking because the hosts were busy trying to make their children stay in bed.
Instead of just being firm and saying, "No more of that. I'm not giving you more attention. This is bedtime, and this is parents' time. Now it's my time as an adult with my friends. You've had your time, this is our time. And go to bed. That's it." Well, they don't do that. I don't know why they don't do that, but they don't do that. They can't do it. They keep just serving their kids. And I see that, and I'm just blown away.
Dominique still adores New York, and much prefers American schools to French ones. But in matters of parenting, she has increasingly reverted to French habits, with their clear rules and boundaries.
The French way sometimes is too harsh. They could be a little more gentle and friendly with kids, I think, she says. But I think the American way takes it way to the extreme of raising kids as if they are ruling the world.
I find it hard to argue with my would-be doppelganger. I can picture those dinner parties she's describing. American parents, myself included, are often deeply ambivalent about being in charge. In theory, we believe that kids need limits. This is a truism of American parenting. However, in practice, we're often unsure where these limits should be or we're uncomfortable policing them.
I feel more guilty for getting angry than I feel angry,
is how a college friend of Simon's justifies his 3-year-old daughter's bad behavior. A girlfriend of mine says her 3-year-old son bit her, but she felt bad yelling at him because she knew that it would make him cry, so she let it go. Anglophone parents worry that being too strict will break their kids' creative spirits. A visiting American mother was shocked when she saw a playpen in our apartment in Paris. Apparently back home, even playpens are now seen as too confining. We didn't know. In Paris, they're de rigueur. A mother from Long Island tells me about her badly behaved nephew, whose parents were, in her view, alarmingly permissive. But she says the nephew has since grown up to become head of oncology at a major American medical center, vindicating the fact that he was an unbearable child. I think kids who are very intelligent and not much disciplined are insufferable when they're kids, but I think they are less stifled creatively when they're older, she says. It's very hard to know where the correct limits lie. By forcing Leo to stay in a playpen or in the sandbox, am I preventing him from one day curing cancer? Where does his free expression end and pointless bad behavior begin? When I let my kids stop and study every manhole cover we pass on the sidewalk, are they following their bliss or turning into brats? A lot of Anglophone parents I know find themselves in an awkward in-between zone, where they're trying to be both dictator and muse to their children. The result is that they end up constantly negotiating. I get my first taste of this when Bean is about 3. Our new house rule is that she's allowed to watch 45 minutes of television per day. One day she asks to watch a bit more. No, you've already had your TV time for today, I say.
But when I was a baby, I didn't watch any TV, she says.
Like us, most Anglophone parents I know have at least some limits. But with so many different parenting philosophies in play, there are other parents who oppose authority altogether. I meet one of them on a visit to the United States. Liz is a graphic designer in her mid-30s, with a 5-year-old daughter named Ruby. She easily ticks off her main parenting influences, the pediatrician William Sears, the author Alfie Cohn, and the behaviorist B.F. Skinner. When Ruby acts up, Liz and her husband try to convince the girl that her behavior is morally wrong. We want to extinguish unacceptable behaviors without resorting to power plays, Liz tells me. I try not to exploit the fact that I'm larger and stronger than she by physically restraining her. Similarly, I try not to resort to the fact that I have all the money by saying, you can have this thing or not. I'm touched by the exacting effort that Liz has put into constructing her approach to parenting. She hasn't merely adopted someone else's rules. She has carefully digested the work of several thinkers and come up with a thoughtful hybrid. The new way of parenting that she's created is, she says, a complete break from the way that she herself grew up. But there are costs. Liz says that this eclectic style and her desire not to be judged for it have isolated her from many of her neighbors and peers, and even from her own parents. She says her parents are bewildered and overtly disapproving of how she's raising Ruby, and that she can no longer discuss it with them. Visits home are tense, especially when Ruby acts up. Nevertheless, Liz and her husband remain determined not to flaunt their authority. Lately, Ruby has been hitting them both. Each time, they sit her down and discuss why hitting is wrong. This well-intentioned reasoning isn't helping. She still hits us, Liz says. France feels like a different planet. Even the most bohemian parents boast about how strict they are and seem unequivocal about being at the top of the family hierarchy. In a country that reveres revolution and climbing the barricades, there are apparently no anarchists at the family dinner table.
It's paradoxical, admits Judith, the art historian and mother of 3 in Brittany.
Judith says she's anti-authority in her political views, but that when it comes to parenting, she's the boss. Full stop.
It's parents, then children, she says, the family pecking order. In France, she explains, sharing power with a child doesn't exist. In the French media, and among the older generation, there's talk about encroaching child king syndrome. But when I talk to parents in Paris, what I hear all the time is, c'est moi qui décide. It's me who decides. There's another slightly more militant variation, c'est moi qui commande. It's me who commands. Parents say these phrases to remind both their kids and themselves who's the boss. To Americans, this hierarchy can look like tyranny. Robin is an American who lives just outside Paris with her French husband and their two kids, Adrian and Leah. Over a family dinner at her apartment one night, she tells me about taking Adrian to the pediatrician when he was a toddler. Adrian cried and refused to step on the scale, so Robin knelt down to persuade him. The doctor interrupted. He said, "Don't explain to him why, just say, 'That's why. That's what you're doing. You're going on the scale. That's it. There's no discussion.'" Robin was shocked. She says she eventually changed pediatricians because she found this one too severe. Robin's husband, Mark, has been listening to this story.
"No, no, that's not what he said," Mark interjects.
Mark is a professional golfer who grew up in Paris. He's one of those French parents who seem to wear their authority quite effortlessly. I notice the way his kids listen carefully when he speaks to them and respond immediately. Mark says the doctor wasn't being wantonly bossy. To the contrary, he was helping with Adrian's éducation. Mark remembers the incident quite differently.
"He said that you have to be sure of yourself, that you have to take your kid and put him on the scale. If you give him too many choices, he doesn't feel reassured. You have to show him that's the way it is, and it's not a bad way or a good way, it's just the way."
"It's a simple gesture, but it's the start of everything," Mark adds.
"You have certain things that don't need explanation. You need to weigh the kid, so you take the kid and put the kid on the scale. Period. Period."
He says the fact that Adrian found the experience unpleasant was part of the lesson.
"Sometimes there are things in life you don't really like, and you have to do them," he says. "You don't always do what you love or what you want to."
When I ask Mark how he got his authority, it's clear that it's not as effortless as it looks. He has put enormous effort into establishing this dynamic with his kids. Having authority is something that he thinks very hard about and considers a priority. All this effort springs from his belief that having a parent who's confident is reassuring to kids.
"For me, it's better to have a leader, someone who shows the way," he says. "A kid has to feel like the mom is in control or the dad."
"Just like when you're on a horse,"
Adrian, now age 9, chimes in.
"Good comparison," Robin says.
Mark adds, "We have a saying in French. It's easier to loosen the screw than to tighten the screw, meaning that you have to be very tough. If you're too tough, you loosen. But if you are too lenient, afterward to tighten, forget about it."
Mark is describing the cadre that French parents spend the early years of a child's life constructing. They construct it in part by establishing their own right to say sometimes, "Just get on the scale." American parents like me just assume that we'll have to chase our kids around the park all afternoon or spend half a dinner party putting them to bed. It's irritating, but it's come to seem normal. For French parents, living with a child king seems wildly out of balance and bad for the whole family. They think it would drain much of the pleasure from daily life for both the parents and the kids. They know that building this cadre requires enormous effort, but they believe that the alternative is unacceptable. It's obvious to French parents that the cadre is the only thing standing between them and 2-hour good nights.
"In America, it's accepted that when you have kids, your time is not your own," Mark tells me. In his view, "the kids need to understand that they're not the center of attention. They need to understand that the world doesn't revolve around them."
So how do parents build this cadre? The process of constructing it does occasionally seem harsh.
But it isn't just about saying no and establishing that it's me who decides. Another way that French parents and educators build the cadre is simply by talking a lot about the cadre. That is, they spend a lot of time telling their kids what's permissible and what's not. All this talk seems to will the cadre into existence. It starts to take on an almost physical presence, much like a good mime convinces you there's actually a wall. This ongoing conversation about the cadre is often very polite. Parents say please a lot, even to babies. They require politeness too, of course, since they understand what's being said. In defining limits for kids, French parents often invoke the language of rights. Rather than saying, "Don't hit Jules," they typically say, "You don't have the right to hit Jules." This is more than a semantic difference. It feels different to say it this way. The French phrasing suggests that there's a fixed and coherent system of rights, which both children and adults can refer to. It also makes clear that the child does have a right to do other things. Kids pick up this phrase and police each other. A schoolyard chant for little kids is the rhyming, "Oh là là, on n'a pas le droit de faire ça." Oh là là, we don't have the right to do that. Another phrase that adults use a lot with children is, "I don't agree," as in, "I don't agree with you pitching your peas on the floor." Parents say this in a serious tone while looking directly at the child. "I don't agree" is also more than just no. It establishes the adult as another mind, which the child must consider. And it credits the child with having his own view about the peas, even if this view is being overruled. Pitching the peas is cast as something the child has rationally decided to do, so he can decide to do otherwise too. This may help explain why mealtimes in France are so calm. Instead of waiting for a big crisis and resorting to dramatic punishments, parents and caregivers focus on making lots of small, polite, preventative adjustments based on well-established rules. I see this at the crèche when I sit in with the 18-month-olds for another fabulous 4-course lunch. 6 little kids wearing matching pink terry cloth bibs are sitting around a rectangular table as Anne-Marie oversees the meal. The atmosphere is extremely calm. Anne-Marie describes the foods in each course and tells the children what's coming out next. I notice that she also closely watches everything they do and, without raising her voice, comments on small infractions.
"Doucement, gently, we don't do that with a spoon," she says to a boy who started banging his spoon on the table. "No, no, no, we don't touch the cheese, it's for later," she tells another.
When she speaks to a child, she always makes eye contact with him. French parents and caregivers don't always resort to this level of micromanagement. I've noticed that they tend to do it more at mealtimes, when there are more small gestures and rules, and more risk of chaos if things go wrong. Anne-Marie does this combination of conversation and corrections throughout the 30-minute meal. By the end, the kids' faces are smeared with food, but there is just a crumb or two on the floor. Like Mark and Anne-Marie, the French parents and caregivers I meet have authority without seeming like dictators. They don't aspire to raise obedient robots. To the contrary, they listen and talk to their kids all the time. In fact, the adults I meet who have the most authority all speak to children not as a master to a subject, but as one equal to another.
"You must always explain the reason
for something that's forbidden," Anne-Marie tells me. When I ask French parents what they most want for their children, they say things like to feel comfortable in their own skin and to find their path in the world. They want their kids to develop their own tastes and opinions. In fact, French parents worry if their kids are too docile. They want them to have character. But they believe that children can achieve these goals only if they respect boundaries and have self-control. So, alongside character, there has to be cadre. It's hard to be around so many well-behaved kids and around parents with such high expectations. Day after day, I am embarrassed when the boys start shouting loudly or whining practically every time we walk through the courtyard between our elevator and the main entrance to our building. It's like an announcement to the dozens of people whose apartments open onto the courtyard. The Americans have arrived. Bean and I are invited to one of her schoolmates' homes for a goûter one afternoon during the Christmas holidays. The kids are served hot chocolate and cookies. I'm given tea. Once we're all sitting around the table, Bean decides that it's a good moment to do some bêtises. She takes a swig of her hot chocolate, then spits it back into her mug. I'm mortified. I'd kick Bean under the table if I could be sure which set of legs was hers. I do hiss at her to stop, but I don't want to ruin the moment by making too much of a fuss. Meanwhile, our hostess's three daughters are sitting sagely around the table, nibbling on their cookies. I see how French parents construct cadres. What I don't understand is how they calmly keep their kids in the cadre. I can't help but think of that adage. If you want to keep a man in a ditch, you have to get in the ditch with him. It's a bit like that at our house. If I send Bean to her room, I have to stay in the room with her, otherwise she'll come out again. Empowered by that episode in the park with Leo, I'm trying to be strict all the time, but this doesn't always work. I'm not sure when to tighten the screw and when to loosen it. For some guidance, I make a lunch date with Madeleine, a French nanny who worked for Robin and Mark. She lives in a small city in Brittany in western France, but is currently working the overnight shift with a new baby in Paris. The child is searching for his nights, Madeleine says. Madeleine, 63, is the mother of three boys. She has short, graying brown hair and a warm smile. She radiates that total certainty I see in Frédéric and other French parents I meet. Like them, she has a calm conviction about her methods. "The more spoiled a child is, the more unhappy he is," she tells me almost as soon as we sit down. So how does she keep her charges in line? "Les gros yeux," she says. This means the big eyes. Madeleine demonstrates these for me at the table. As she does, she suddenly morphs from a grandmotherly lady in a matching pink scarf and sweater into a scary-looking owl. Even just for show, she has a lot of conviction. I want to learn the big eyes, too. When our salads arrive, we practice. At first, I have trouble doing the owl without cracking up. But as with Frédéric in the park, when I finally hit the point of real conviction, I can feel the difference. Then I don't feel like laughing. Madeleine says that she's not just trying to frighten children into submission. She says the big eyes work best when she has a strong connection with the child and when there's mutual respect. Madeleine says the most satisfying part of her job is developing complicity with a child, as if they're seeing the world the same way, and when she almost knows what the child is about to do before he does it. Getting to this point requires carefully observing him, talking with him, and trusting him with certain freedoms. Indeed, to build a relationship with a child in which the big eyes work, she says strictness must come with flexibility, including giving kids autonomy and choices.
"I think you need to leave kids a bit of liberty. Let their personalities show," she says.
Madeleine doesn't see any contradictions between having this strong, reciprocal relationship and also being very firm. Her authority seems to come from inside the relationship with children, not from above it. She's able to balance complicity and authority.
"You must listen to the child, but it's up to you to fix the limits," she says.
The big eyes are famous in France. Bean was scared of getting them at the creche. Many French adults still remember being on the receiving end of the big eyes and other similar expressions.
"She had this look," Clotilde Dusselier, the Parisian food writer, says of her mother.
With both her parents,
"there was this tone of voice they used when all of a sudden they felt you had stepped over a line. They had a facial expression that was stern and annoyed and not happy. They would say, 'No, you don't say that.' You would feel chastised and a bit humiliated. It would pass."
What's interesting to me is that Clotilde remembers les gros yeux and the cadre of the look enforced, very fondly.
"She's always been very clear on what was okay and what wasn't," she says of her mother.
She managed to be both affectionate and have authority without ever raising her voice.
Speaking of voice raising, I seem to do it quite a lot. Shouting does sometimes succeed in getting the kids to brush their teeth or wash their hands before dinner, but it takes a lot out of me and creates an awful ambiance. The louder I yell, the worse I feel about it afterward, and the more tired I am. French parents do speak sharply to their kids, but they prefer surgical strikes to constant carpet bombing. Shouting is saved for important moments when they really want to make a point. When I shout at my kids in the park or at home, when we have French friends over, the parents look alarmed, as if they think that there's been a serious offense. American parents like me often view imposing authority in terms of discipline and punishment. French parents don't talk much about these things. Instead, they talk about the éducation of kids. As the word suggests, this is about gradually teaching children what's acceptable and what's not.